Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of April. Our guest this hour is the author of Adam's Tongue, How Humans Made Language, How Language Made Humans. In the intro to the book, he says, you can try this at home. It's what's called a thought experiment. Thought experiments are vital to science. Without thought experiments, we'd never have had the theory of relativity. If Einstein had not imagined what riding on a beam of light would be like, or what would happen if two gangsters shot at each other, one in a moving elevator, one outside, we'd still be stuck with the Newtonian universe. This particular thought experiment is simple. You just have to imagine for a moment that you don't have language and nobody else has either. Not speech, mind you, but language. Professor Derek Bickerton is Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the University of Hawaii. His most recent book, Bastard Tongues, was published in 2008. And Adam's Tongue, of course, looks at language. And we're going to welcome phone calls for him and also emails for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well. And that address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Bickerton, thank you so much for being with us. Hello.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
Hi, very nice to have you here. You start with this thought experiment. If we think about not having language, how do you answer that? What happens?
Well, what happens is that everything kind of falls apart. there isn't any kind of civilization whatsoever. Everything we do that differentiates us from other species involves the use of language, either speaking or reading instructions or doing something with language. So that without it, I mean, we're just not human.
Language makes us human, you say?
Absolutely.
And you also say maybe it's the only thing that makes us human.
Yeah.
Is that right? It is?
That's what I'm saying.
Huh.
I know that sounds a bit of a stretch, but just think about it for a moment. We are very similar to apes in all other respects. We've studied the ape's social life. We know many of the features, what we thought were unique to humans, are in fact things that apes can do. So if you subtract language, what you get is just about an ape.
I got to tell you, we look pretty close to that ape you've got on the cover of your book. The eyes on that ape are extraordinary.
Well, he's not really an ape. He's halfway, shall we say, between ape and human. Here's the, Homo erectus at the dawn of language 2 million years ago as an artist's representation of what he thought the first creature that spoke would have looked like.
It's quite a picture, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's quite stunning, yeah.
Yes, it's very stunning. Why is it that language is the greatest problem in science?
Because it's very difficult to get a handle on for a variety of reasons, because it doesn't leave fossils, it doesn't leave any marks in the fossil record, and because it involves, there are so many different disciplines that are involved directly or indirectly in examining it. So you have to be not just a generalist, you have to be a specialist in several fields. And you have to be able to, what should we say, work inwards from what we discovered in these different fields to try and narrow the problem space so that you can at least speculate on how this thing might have come about.
And when you answer the question, how we got language, mm-hmm. What are we looking at? How did we get language?
Mm. Well, the idea basically is that you have to ask yourself how language is different from systems by which other animals communicate. It turns out to be different on a whole variety of parameters, but probably the most crucial is that anything animals can communicate about is what is happening right now, what's right before their eyes, what they're feeling, what they're hearing, and so forth. And that's not what language does. Language can be used to talk about literally anything, whether it even things that don't exist or may not exist or probably don't exist, we can still talk about those things. And whether they're here or thousands of miles away makes no difference.
Mm-hmm. Do we have to be able to remember quite a bit to have highly sophisticated language?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There are a lot of things. A lot of infrastructure had to be put in before the before you could get to where we are now. But what I suggest in the book is that not all that infrastructure was there when language began. And in a sense, language built its own infrastructure. It pulled itself up by its bootstraps, so to speak.
And when you think about the first person who said something, what made somebody want to say something, and what would they have said?
Well, you see, that's the point. The point that you have to look at is this. The most remarkable thing about language is that while we have it in a highly sophisticated form, there's no other species that has it even in the most rudimentary form. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves why this is. There must be something different about the human condition, or must have been something different at some stage in our evolution that made us need to be able to do things that other animals couldn't do. Since there's no total novelties, I thought of looking a little further than the apes or even mammals or even vertebrates to ask myself if humans at any stage of their evolution had experienced any kind of lifestyle that demanded something extra. And of course there is a precedent. The bees and ants are able to communicate in some ways in a more sophisticated way than other animals because they can communicate, even a very, very limited extent, but they can communicate about things that aren't there. And the reason they have to do this is because both bees and ants forage, large bodies of food, bodies that are too large for individuals or even small groups to utilize fully. So in other words, what they need to do is to communicate about food sources so they can recruit fellow members to go out and help them get this food. And the situation arose in humans and in no other member of the primate family. It arose in the following way, because about 2 million years ago, there was the drying process had reached its climax, and humans were inhabiting very broad grasslands in eastern southern Africa. There was very little to eat apart from meat, and the only way that we could have survived was if we could manage to scavenge large carcasses. There were lots of large dead herbivores lying around, but there's also a lot of competition for these carcasses. Now, what humans had to be able to do was to recruit sufficient numbers to be able to drive off the competition, commandeer these carcasses of mammoths and dinotherms, whatever they were, or huge hippopotami and so forth. Well, they would then pile on, so to speak, with some of them driving off the other carnivores while the rest of them carved up the animal. They had a tremendous advantage that no other animal had because they'd already developed very, very primitive tools which involved both flakes and choppers. The flakes were sharp enough to cut through the hides of large beasts, and the choppers were effective enough to separate bone and muscle so they could hack off large chunks of meat and carry them off to some relatively safe place while the others bombarded the other scavengers with rocks and held them off. Mm-hmm. But the key to this, of course, was the ability to be able to tell a fellow member of your group or even maybe a member of some other group, in effect, that there is a large dead animal just a couple of 3 miles away over the hill there. You can't see it, but there it is. And obviously the means by which they conveyed this information was extremely crude, probably imitating the noises the animal made or something of that effect and making gestures to the effect, you know, come with us and so forth. So it would have been a very, basic and crude method of communication. But the point was that it would have broken through this barrier of time and space, the barrier that kept all other forms of animal communication in the here and now. And once that had started, see, if you start something going like that in the brain of an ant, well, the brain of an ant is about the size of a head of a, well, not even a head, a pinpoint probably, and you can't do a lot with it. But when you have a primate brain of several hundred cc's, then that's going to start to work, and that brain is going to find other means, other ways in which it can make use of this new capacity to communicate about things that are not in the present and not immediately visible. Mm.
Yeah. Well, why is it in the human brain and not in, you know, the monkey brain?
Well, the monkey brain has, certainly the ape brain, has a lot of the prerequisites. But the point is that they don't need to communicate in this way. They can get along perfectly well by communicating about things right in front of their faces. Nothing in their life demands the capacity, what the linguists call displacement, that is the capacity to speak about things that are not immediately within the sensory field. So once the if you don't have a motive to do something, you don't do it because there's no selective advantage to it. And if there's no selective advantage to it, then evolution is not going to favor it. It's not going to be reinforced and become a fixed trait in a species. So the reason that they don't have language is because they don't need language.
Mm.
We did at one stage.
Right.
Need a very primitive form of language, and then that grew more sophisticated as time went by.
So how do we develop a need? The initial language then was fairly crude. How do we go from that to William Shakespeare?
It took about 2 million years. a lot of things had to happen. And for one thing, a lot of rewiring had to be done in the brain. The brain is to a large extent, a self-organizing machine. I think people don't generally realize the extent to which a brain can self-organize, but it's organized itself most remarkably by separating out all the various sensory information that it gets into specific regions, and then connecting those regions so you can cross-reference, and so on and so forth. So all this is spontaneous evolution on the part of the brain. So once the brain had the most primitive words to deal with, it was going to start figuring out ways in which these words could be put together in more meaningful fashion. But this involved a great deal of rewiring of the brain. And I think for a long time, it probably took a long time to get going, because at first, whatever system of communication we had, this primitive proto-language, must have been rather like be your aunt communication, insofar as it could only probably talk about, you know, there's a dead elephant over the hill kind of thing. But you see, as it would expand, and it must have taken, I think, a long time to expand, hundreds of thousands of years probably, just adding signs very occasionally, probably losing them and then getting them back and so forth. And it was only over a long period that the brain could get to work and build a sophisticated system that would link all the different parts of the brain involved in language. Because that's one of the most stunning realizations, I think, of recent years. Since we've had brain imaging, we've realized that almost any language task is not limited to some language area or language organ, as people once thought, but it involves whole different sections of the brain. But there must have been not new sections of the brain built for language, but new pathways between old sections that were now recruited for doing this new job.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. Professor Derek Bickerton is our guest, Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the University of Hawaii. And his latest book is Adam's Tongue, How Humans Made Language, How Language made humans. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Derek Bickerton is our guest, and we go to phone calls now and start with Kurt from Oxford. Hi, Kurt.
I was curious. I love to dance and studied it a little bit. And there's arguments that that was one of the first forms of communication, which brings to mind the honeybee and the specific code they use with movement to communicate where sources of pollen are. And if you could go into, like, the effect music had on the development of language.
Well, there's a school of thought that believes that music and language had identical origins, but honestly, I'm not too sure about that. You see, even nowadays, except maybe in some rather unusual cultures, I don't know of a way in which a dance can be used to spell out a very specific message. It seems to me that, yes, bees could use dancing, but every species develops its own need. And I think how human language developed originally was through a mixture of modalities. I think it involved speech and gesture and mimicry and all sorts of things at the beginning. It was simply a question of getting your idea across. So although it's fascinating to conjecture about the joint origins of music, dance, and language, I have not seen any very convincing evidence for it. Not so far, anyway.
You include information about bees in your book, don't you? And talk about the first bee wasn't even social. It was every bee for itself back then.
Yep. Right.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Daniel from Rice Lake. Hello, Daniel.
Hello. If you believe in survival of the fittest, why did Latin and especially the dialect of Latin English conquer all the other languages of the world?
Well, I don't think that had much to do with language per se. I think it had a lot to do with politics. You see, there's a very interesting relationship between language and politics. For instance, there was one linguist who said that a language is just a dialect with an army and a navy. And the reason for the spread of English has more to do with the dominance of first of England, later of America, in the world, than it has to do with any particular characteristics of the language itself.
And thanks very much for your call. We go next to Keith from Antigo. Hello, Keith.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering, are you familiar with any other ideas as far as, like, biblical reasons for language being the way it is?
I'm not familiar with a biblical reason. I'm not sure that I don't recall that there's any kind of discussion of that in the Bible, but please correct me if I'm wrong. I do, of course, there was the story of the Tower of Babel, which is a very interesting way of explaining how languages began. But in practice, how they actually began, for instance, was through the human diaspora, through the spread of humans originally from Africa, subsequently throughout the rest of the world. This caused different groups to become isolated from one another, and being isolated, their languages each went their own way.
Yes,
but if you know anything, any other reference in the Bible to language, I'd be very interested to hear it.
Then the God caused them to not to be able to understand one another, to disperse them.
Yeah.
And it, I was just wondering if you're familiar with that and if you actually studied it out.
Well, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that there's a great deal of evidence in there. The Bible was not, I think, designed to be what should we say, an analysis of human psychology and human cognitive capacities. It has spiritual messages that are rather a different, maybe in many ways in a more important nature, but I'm not too sure I would use it as a guide to a problem that has existed and still is not. Nobody really totally agrees on what the solution to it is.
Thanks for the call. You write early in the book that the evolution of language has been dragged nilly-willy into the culture wars, the epic and still unresolved struggle between those who want things to stay the way they are and those for whom they can't change too quickly. Can you elaborate on that?
I don't know if I can say any more than that, except that it seems to me that those issues are really quite irrelevant to any consideration of language. The whole business is a question of comes into the larger question of did humans evolve or were they specially created? And a lot of the resistance to evolution, the theory of evolution, of course, comes from the belief that the Bible, shall we say, is the ultimate answer to any kind of creation story of humans. And a literal interpretation of the Bible. And this is something that has become something that people tend to hold to if they are of a conservative temperament, if they are afraid of change, as many people are. And I often think, well, they've got good reason to be afraid of it because some of the changes that are happening now are not very agreeable. And I think really anyway I happened to mention it in passing in an early part of the book, but I don't regard it as being particularly significant in the overall. When you come to examine the facts, it's an irrelevance. That's why I wanted to dismiss it and get it out of the way.
So it hasn't kept us from a full study of language.
Hopefully not.
Right. What about what's happened? Let's go back to those early grunts and food foraging. What has happened and what have we learned about the development of the brain since those days, about the new pathways that may have been formed? You mentioned this a little bit. Are our brains still evolving, if that's the right word, and if so, in what ways?
Well, I'm sure they are evolving, but it isn't quite clear in what way, and it's not clear that they're evolving in any way that would affect language. We have to assume that language hasn't changed all that much since the human diaspora began, because all languages obey certain principles of universal grammar. Now, these principles must in turn reflect ways in which the human brain processes language. Now, The spread of humans throughout the world began about 90,000 years ago, and it seems to me that there probably has not been any significant change since then, because if there had been a change, it must have affected a group. It couldn't have affected the whole species. Once the whole species had spread out all over the world, anything that that changed in one place would not necessarily affect the rest of the world. So you'd expect to find languages that obey different basic principles. The fact that they don't suggests that the general overall mechanism that the brain uses to create language was fixed, say, 100,000 years ago, and hasn't substantially changed since then. There may have been some fine-tuning going on. We don't know. It's doubtful. Once evolution can do a job well, it generally forgets about it and goes on to other things. So I do believe that we are evolving, and probably in ways that we haven't really understood yet, but that probably doesn't have much to do with language now. It's affecting other things, other areas of behavior.
Mm-hmm. And what about all the research that's been done? We've talked about ants. Certainly a lot has been done with elephants and dolphins and even dogs. What about evolution of those animals and their capacity for more sophisticated language or communication?
Well, there have been studies now of practically, well, I wouldn't say every species, but certainly a large number of species in the way they communicate. And there are still things that we'd like to know. We learned something, for instance, recently, only a short time ago, it was learned that bonobos, the pygmy chimpanzee, can, in fact, make different sounds depending on the different quality of its food. And whether that could in itself have developed into language, it's kind of doubtful. It's rather like the difference between mmm and yum yum. So that, you know, it's that kind of difference. You see, their emotive expressive differences that are directly related to what is happening. And, of course, there are things that we don't know yet. We don't really know how dolphins communicate. We can't totally rule out the possibility that dolphins have developed some kind of language that is so different from ours, because it would consist of clicks and whistles and sonar and all sorts of things that we don't have. It's extremely difficult to study and extremely difficult to find out whether, in fact, they do or not. But let's say that there's no evidence at the moment of any species progressing beyond this kind of here and now stage of communication. That would be interesting if we could find some cases. I agree, and I have an open mind about it. I'm not ruling out the possibility that somewhere some animal may also be approaching the barrier or even starting to breach it, but let's say we don't have any hard evidence so far that they have.
It would be nice if it happened, wouldn't it, and we could talk to them?
Yeah, indeed it would.
I think it'd be great fun.
Yeah, it would indeed, but I wish that, I'm afraid, is still for fairy stories.
Yeah. And what about the reasons that we use language? You talk early about our need to communicate information about food. Is it to exchange that kind of information? Have we been more often than not cooperative? Our language has been cooperative, or has it been confrontational? Has all of that changed during the decades and the centuries?
Well, of course, it can be both confrontational and cooperative. But what's so fascinating about humans and about the effect language had on them. Humans are far more cooperative than any other primate species. More cooperative, in fact, than anything except bees and ants, which are, of course, their society is, of course, structured totally differently, and the whole breeding system is totally different from ours. But somehow, this cooperation developed. I think it started to develop possibly even before language, when we were on the brink of extinction in the savannas, and where we had to watch one another's backs to a much greater extent than other primate species do. And so that's where it began. But basically, the way it continued was in this constant exchange of communication, which is basic to human cooperation. If you can't communicate, you can't cooperate fully, because you don't know what the other person thinks or what the other person wants. And it's important to have some idea of these if you're going to get anywhere with cooperation. So I'm suggesting that really language and cooperation have the same roots, that their history is tangled in ways that we need to probably explore further. But anyway, yes, language and cooperation do indeed go together. Of course, it can also be used confrontationally. But let me say, you see, the interesting thing about language is that it demands a certain amount of trust, and this is unusual because it's language is cheap, and cheap signals are not usually trusted among different animals. So we are fortunate in the sense that somehow we've managed to build this trust, and we managed to believe most of what we hear. Sometimes we believe too much of what we hear, but on the whole, we are willing both to give and receive information via language, and we don't you know, suspect automatically everything anyone says to each other, as animals tend to be very suspicious of each other. One reason why there's generally so little cooperation.
And why is it, do you think, that we have so many of these languages on Earth, so it makes it, in some cases, difficult to cooperate because we have no idea what somebody else is saying?
Yeah. Well, the reasons for that, there's a kind of genetic drift goes on in language insofar as one generation never speaks exactly the same as the next. They're always, we always think our grandparents talk a bit funny, and, of course, then when we become grandparents, we can't understand some of the things our children say. And this is trivial through a couple or three generations, but it mounts up. And so what happens is that languages change over time. To the extent that human groups split up and you have different tribes, different countries, different states, you get each language going its own way. And it only takes a thousand or so years for two languages like this to become mutually incomprehensible. So as you've had a long history of division, of fission, of spreading out into different groups, and of course of conflict between groups, which again reduces conflict between groups, reduces the amount of communication between them. And so we've gotten to the present state where until recently there were about 7,000 human languages. Now that figure is, of course, rapidly going down as languages die, but it's still pretty large.
7,000? I didn't know it was that
high.
That's
a rough ballpark estimate of language complexity at its highest, so to speak.
Oof. Let's welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of Adam's Tongue, How Humans Made Language, How Language Made Humans. Our guest says language has been called the hardest problem in science. Derek Bickerton is a leading authority in this field, and he covers foraging strategies of ants, the distribution of large prehistoric herbivores, the construction of ecological niches. He produces all kinds of fascinating information about language and why it's unique to humans. Not the only thing that sets us apart, our cognitive powers are qualitatively different. So he shows how the possession of words opened a new and different cognitive universe, and we're talking about that and all kinds of different subjects. It's interesting to think about what the word may have been, what the first word was, and why it was used, and when it was used, and then how you went from there to how language has developed. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. We have lines open for you right now, so feel free to use them. We also have an email address, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, and we're talking with Derek Bickerton this hour and about his book. He's Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the University of Hawaii. The book is Adam's Tongue, How Humans Made Language, How Language Made Humans, and we're welcoming more phone calls for him. Our next caller is Lucy from Oshkosh. Hi, Lucy.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. I was just wondering what you guys think the first word may have been from man. I'm sitting here getting ready for the day, and I was thinking maybe it was ouch from when they first made fire.
Well, I don't think it was ouch. It may have been. I mean, ouch may have, but ouch isn't really a word. It's an exclamation. And really, there are a lot of things like ouch or wow or yum yum, which are much more like animal communication signals than they are like words, because the real test of a word is, can you combine it with anything else? And you can say, ouch, I just hit my thumb, but the ouch isn't part of the sentence. I just hit my thumb. It's not the subject or object of any verb, or it has any connection with the rest of the sentence. So ouch may have been an early exclamation, but I doubt it was the first word. I think the first word must have been probably some kind of sound, probably some trumpeting sound that indicated elephant or something of that. It would be something of that nature. We probably wouldn't even have recognized that it was a word, if we could somehow recreate that word. It wouldn't be like modern words, but it would have a similar function in that it conveyed information about something that the recipient couldn't see or hear.
Okay. Would you consider, like, ouch and those kind of sayings, like, universal? Do you think it would be, everyone would kind of say, like, ooh, like, make some kind of noise, and then you would figure that first noise would be the start to the speaking, because they have to verbalize in some way.
Yeah, but it's, you see, speaking isn't necessarily language. A parrot can speak. A lot of avians are very good at mimicry. So the actual power of speech itself is not that important. Language really is a basic way of referring to things and putting things together. And you can do this with sign. I mean, deaf people do it all the time. The American Sign Language, or any sign language anywhere in the world, is just as much a language as a spoken language. So really the modality isn't important. It's the mechanism behind the modality, what enables us to speak or sign or use any kind of communication method in such a way that elements that refer to specific things out there in the world can be strung together to make meaningful propositions. That's basically what language is, not speaking or signing or anything. These are modalities. These are ways of doing the job.
Thank you so much for the call, Lucy. Here's an email. My question is, if humans developed language to avoid extinction, why was it not possible for other species to develop language as their species were threatened or eventually wiped out? Also, what's the oldest spoken language? This is from Latif.
Those are some interesting questions, but it's hard to answer them. Answer the second one first. The oldest spoken language, we don't know for sure. We know Sanskrit is pretty old, probably the oldest, but that we don't know how far back that goes, because we don't have only when writing began did we get actual can we actually date a language from. And languages, of course, existed for tens of thousands of years before there was any way of writing them down. So it's really anybody's guess what the oldest language is. As for the other question, why animals on the brink of extinction don't produce language, well, probably because language wouldn't have saved them for whatever was making them extinct. The point of humans was that there was a particular, very specific way in which they could survive if they were able to exploit large carcasses. And this is not the kind of way out that's available to very many species, perhaps to no other species. Everything depends on whatever ecological niche a species finds, because it's the niche that will shape the species and the demands of the niche and what you have to do in the niche in order to survive. And if what you have to do involves communicating at a distance, so to speak, then the chances are, if you've already, a species already evolved far enough to have the basic tools for that, then it will take that course. But to the best of our knowledge, this has only ever happened to one species in the whole history of evolution.
Thank you so much, Lucy, or Latif, rather, for your call, and Lucy for your call, Latif, for your email. We go next to Rob in Madison. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Kathleen. Good morning.
Hello.
And good morning to Professor Bickerton. Hi, are you there?
Hi, good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to know where the professor comes down on the great language acquisition divide. is he, I'm sure he's familiar with Michael Tomasello and his usage-based theory. And I'm wondering if he is an adherent of that theory or if he believes in Noam Chomsky's universal grammar.
Well, I think Chomsky is nearer the mark than Tomasello. I think there are certain things about language that can only be explained if we have some kind of inbuilt mechanism that guides the acquisition of language. And, of course, usage is important, but usage alone could not have produced a language that obeyed all the various rules and principles that language obeys, that you can easily imagine there could have been different kinds of language and there aren't. And maybe one of the reasons that I think this is a personal accident in my career, I happened to come to language evolution from the study of pidgin and creole languages. And a pidgin, which is a formless kind of language without any fixed grammar, can develop in a single generation into a full language if it's acquired by children. And I don't see how this could be done. The children are, in fact, producing sentences that their parents would not have been able to produce. I don't see how this can be done through usage, because there hasn't been any usage of this particular new language, this creole language, that has developed out of the pidgin.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob, for your call. David is next. Hello, David.
Hello. For having me on.
Sure, David.
I was very interested and enjoying the program about the evolution of language and the speculation that the professor is sharing with us on how he thinks perhaps language evolved. And I thought I would add my speculation too. However, from a biblical point of view, you're looking for the first word that may have been sent or may have been said, I think. And what I would speculate is that when Adam had been created, and then God felt that he might need a partner in woman, and put him to sleep and created woman, when he woke up and saw Eve for the first time, I think what he would have said would be the first word to another human being, "Wow."
Well, again, if he said wow, that wouldn't have been a real word, because wow or yum yum or ouch and all those things are interjections that are kind of like any things other things did. Adam may have developed something further, more specific at a later stage, but I don't think that would have been. It may well have been his reaction, but it still wouldn't have been the first real word.
Mm. We'll never know what the first real word will we ever. I mean, how do you find out? You would never know.
Without a time machine, I don't see how you
right.
do it. All you can do about this is
have
speculate.
Fun. Right. And it is fun to speculate. Thanks, David, very much for the call. Let's go to an email here. Your research on language is music to my ears, says Sharon from Hayward. I've always thought that it was not only language but a written language that pushed us to the top of the food chain. If Einstein had relied on me to pass on the theory of relativity, I'm sorry to say I would have failed. The brightest human minds have been reading books and advancing and building in those ideas through hundreds of years. Our society is built on those layers and layers of ideas, something I feel we take for granted.
Well, that's very true. And there has been, of course, an immense acceleration in civilization since writing is discovered. That has been probably the major engine in creating the world that we know today. But this doesn't mean that the writing in and of itself increased or augmented our cognitive powers in any way. I think that human cognition has been pretty powerful for tens of thousands of years, long before writing began. It's just that that intelligence could be more efficiently exploited once somebody had mastered the trick of writing things down. And it's true, you're quite right, of course, that without that, we wouldn't have the theory of evolution or the theory of anything else. It was only when people started to write things down and read each other's writings and criticize them and develop them and improve them, that's the only thing that really pushed human thought forward.
Jim is next from Pleasant Prairie. Hello, Jim.
Yes, good morning and fascinating program. Sometimes I wonder if the position and configuration of our larynx has just enabled us to create much more sophisticated languages than the other mammals. But another point I wanted to make was it seems that humanity, and I hope it's completely not out of the parameters of this program, seems to be the only maker of music.
That is true. That is absolutely true. And as I said earlier on, there is a school of thought that believes that these two things are very intimately linked. I don't happen to agree with that, but there is a good deal of, writing or has been done to try and demonstrate that there is some connection.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. We go to Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Good morning, Kathleen, and hello, Professor Rickerton. Kind of a compound question. In language, how would you define rhymes in language? Is it an attempt to communicate more efficiently or just a tool to assist children in learning the language?
I think I'm not sure how rhyme began. There is a certain pleasure that people have always taken in sounds for their own sake, even without those sounds necessarily having meaning. So how rhyming began is a fascinating question that I've never really had a chance to get to grips with. So I'm really not competent to answer your question. But I do think that probably children's play has a lot to do with it. If you find that the kind of games children develop often involve some kind of rhyming thing, and children are always kind of pleased and excited by rhymes. This is something that another of the many aspects of language that we need to look into further.
Daryl, thank you very much for your call. We have an email if you want to take on the issue of autism. This is an interesting email, Professor. I have four children. The youngest two have autism. My son can barely speak, although he understands many words. He has great trouble forming sounds. My daughter, Celeste, speaks haltingly but writes with great sophistication and is in the National Honor Society. As a small child, Celeste did not speak but seemingly taught herself to read. She was on a computer from about age two. My eldest son in his 20s visited one weekend and spent time with her and told me, "Did you know she can read?" I didn't believe this and asked him how he knew. He then typed a letter to Celeste on her computer, the last sentence of which was, "Give me a kiss." She sat down and Nate told her to read it. She appeared to do so. And then Nate said, "Well, can you respond to that? It's an interesting story."
Well, it's a fascinating story, and what it spells out, I think, is that autism has been described as a spectrum, and I think it's really people haven't really got a handle on it. I think autism kind of conflates a lot of different conditions, neurological conditions, some of which are present at birth. Some of which are induced in the early years of life for causes that we don't yet fully understand. One rather frightening thing is that the amount of autism has dramatically increased, and I'm not sure it's just, you know, better diagnosis. I think there really has been a big increase in autism over the last few years. This raises so many issues that we could go into. They're fascinating, but unless this is a specific question, I really can't say much more than that.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing the book. It's quite fascinating. Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have been with you.
Our guest this hour, Professor Derek Bickerton. The book is Adam's Tongue: How Humans Made Language, How Language Made Humans. It has just been published by Hill and Wang. And Professor Bickerton is Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the University of Hawaii. His other books, and he has many of them, most recent book before this one, Bastard Tongues, published in 2008. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, and thanks to John Treader and Sherry Esser for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and for all of your calls. They're great. It's wonderful to have you engaged in such a variety of topics. It's a real pleasure to do this show. We do want to tell you, where is that note? Here it is. Tomorrow, NPR News is going to be providing live anchored coverage of President Barack Obama's press conference. It's taking place tomorrow, 7 Central Time, marking his first 100 days in office. So that's tomorrow, April 29th already. Robert Siegel will be hosting our coverage, and he will be joined by senior Washington editor Ron Elving and White House correspondent Don Gagne, also Pentagon correspondent Mary Louise Kelly, and economics correspondent John Yitzhi will be among the many people tomorrow responding to the press conference. And we are looking at President Barack Obama's first 100 days tomorrow at 9 o'clock, the first hour of our program tomorrow. So that is that. Thanks for listening. We have news coming up from National Public Radio in just a moment, and then many hours of great conversation ahead. So stay with the Ideas Network. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.